How good are you at learning from past mistakes? 10 days ago, we held our first messy church at the local primary school. 60 pupils all coming in to do church in a very different way. And it went really well. The children had a great time. I think we did too. But we left absolutely exhausted, burned out completely, and under the impression that primary school teachers should be paid triple the salary they're actually receiving. Now, it's not that we made particularly big mistakes, but there are little things that we learnt that will help us to improve when we do it next time. For example, never underestimate a child's capacity to be distracted. Never underestimate a child's capacity to misinterpret instructions. They do it unbelievably well. Never be overambitious, as we probably were, and fit too much into it. The children almost certainly will cope, but you won't. And never assume that you're going to have, even in a two-hour slot, even 1 minute to stop, have a rest, and have a cup of tea. Because the children are so intense, so wanting to know what comes next, you don't have a moment to breathe. So if you've not had a drink before you go in, you could be in trouble. These are the sort of lessons that we've learned about that first session. Do you know, there is a well-known expression: those who fail to learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat them. Well, in this chapter that we've been looking at, that's the attitude that the Apostle Paul has. He wants these people in this young church that he's just established to learn such crucial lessons from history, from other people who also thought they were so close to God, about the dangers of dabbling with idols and idolatry. In the previous couple of chapters, he's been speaking about food which has been offered to idols. And one of the things that occurs is there was so much of this food offered to idols, there was an excess, and the excess was sold in the marketplace, which caused people to ask the question, is it all right for Christians to go to the marketplace and eat of this food that's been offered to idols? A reasonable question. And Paul says, look, this sacrifice food has been offered to idols which aren't actually real. They don't exist, they're just idols, false gods. So the food is not being contaminated. There's no problem, it's just food, you can eat whatever you like. That bit, they'd understood and they'd got right. But they were still in danger of taking that and interpreting it in such a way that they thought they could do anything when it came to idols and idolatry. That anything went. And they were in real danger of falling down the same mistakes that the people of Israel had made all that time before. And it's the people of Israel that he's talking to in these really strange terms that he uses when he describes them. Their forefathers are being people under the cloud who passed through the sea. But he's speaking about events that took place in the Exodus when the people of Israel were taken out of Egypt and led through the desert, and they were led by God by a cloud in the daytime. So the people under the cloud. And then, of course, they crossed the Red Sea, the waters being held back while Pharaoh is hard on their tail, wanting to capture them again. So they were passing through the waters. And through these different experiences, they've got something in common as a group of people. So he describes them as being all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. That's what he's referring to. Paul is seeing these unique events that they have been through with God as being similar to someone being baptized into Christ. He's using terminology that they would understand. So they're all linked. They're linked by this experience of God, one body of people experience God's blessing and God's leading through the desert. So they ate the same spiritual food and drink. That's manna, if you remember the stories from Exodus, bread from heaven. And then the water that came from the rock, do you remember that? Moses, on a couple of occasions, struck the rock, fresh water flowed out and provided for the people. And Paul speaks into these areas. But the way he writes about it is quite strange. There's a reason for this. Some people at this time were writing as though there was literally a physical rock that was moving with the people of Israel through the desert, and it was full of water. You know, you tap it and the water comes out. Paul doesn't believe that, but he does believe that this is a sort of symbolic of the hidden spiritual presence of Christ journeying with them. That's what he's referring to. You've got a picture here of people who have been through some remarkable events and have been consistently provided for by God. People who are known as the people of God. It's a pretty strong description. And yet, these are the very people who almost every one of them has slipped into behavior that was completely unacceptable and inappropriate for God's people. And in the next few verses, 7, 8, 9, and 10, Paul lists just what this idolatrous behavior is. So in verse 7, the people sat down to eat and drink and indulge in pagan revelry. Exodus 32. This is the people have arrived at Mount Sinai. Moses has gone up the mountain to receive the Ten Commandments, but he's away for such a long time that the people start to get restless and they start worshipping a golden calf. Astonishing behavior. And then in verse 8, they worshipped a completely different god, Baal, and engaged in sexual immorality. In verse 9, he speaks about them complaining, moaning about the food and putting God to the test because of it. And in verse 10, they're complaining about the leadership of Moses and of God. Four significant areas where their behavior is idolatrous. Isn't it interesting? God's people, set aside by God, rescued from slavery, provided for, called to obedience, and yet they've succumbed to this temptation to go into idolatry. This is the lesson that Paul wants people to learn. However close you think you are to God, just beware of the temptation of idolatry. And the lesson that Paul gives them is this. There are consequences of idolatrous behavior, even for people who call themselves God's people. Dreadful consequences, and they are listed in those verses. Thousands of people dying. Well, the Corinthians too are God's people, but they are also in real danger of going down the same dangerous route and getting involved in things they shouldn't be. It's interesting because they thought they couldn't be touched by these idols. They'd understood quite rightly that idols were not real. They couldn't be touched by them. But they misunderstood something else. He's referring to this mistaken self-confidence that because food that is sacrificed to idols is just food, the idols aren't real, so it's just fat and meat, there's no problem consuming that. They'd misunderstood something else. They thought that idols themselves were not dangerous, so we can do what we like. But they'd crossed the line in the process, and they were going to the temple where idols were being worshipped, and they were eating there too. About 12, 13 years ago, there was a film that came out at the cinema. It wasn't a great film. And it was called The Tuxedo. It was a martial arts film, I think, with Jackie Chan. Anyone heard of the film, Tuxedo? Yeah. It wasn't great, was it? But never mind. It was about a chauffeur. And the chauffeur was the chauffeur for a secret agent. And the secret agent, he was just this brilliant guy. inadvertently, he tried on the dinner jacket, the tuxedo that belonged to his boss. And suddenly the chauffeur felt himself clothed with almost immortality. He could do anything. Evil couldn't touch him. It is as though the Corinthian Christians feel they're in the same position. They feel that somehow, because they've become Christians, because they're protected by Jesus, because salvation is secured and their eternity is absolutely certain, that it can do whatever they like in life. And the tragedy is, I actually really believe many Christians today feel exactly the same way. Why worry about holiness? Why worry about the things that we watch, the things that we do, the company that we keep, the time that we spend away from God? After all, don't we wear what is described in the New Testament as clothes of righteousness? We are clothed in righteousness. It's like this invisible cloak of holiness that protects us. We're described as being the righteousness of God. And there is a sense amongst many Christians that that means we can do whatever we like because eternity is assured. Well, it's partly right. Eternity is assured for God's people. But you know, in this world, that doesn't mean you're not exposed to all the works of the enemy to trip us up and pull us down. We're exposed to just the same things in this world that corrupt, that mislead, that damage both God's people and those that we are called to witness to. We are not free to live as we like. We are called to a life of holiness, a life of reverence. Actually, the Bible tells us to put on the armor of God. There's a reason you put armor on. You need to be protected from what the enemy is going to throw at you. And just because we've been baptized into Christ, because we come around the communion table and eat bread and wine, and we have fellowship with the saints, doesn't mean that we are somehow released from taking this extra moral effort and demonstrating restraint. Because we remain human, we remain subject to temptation, temptation that's common to all human beings. But as verse 13 screams at us, God is faithful. And we will not be tempted beyond anything that we cannot endure. I don't have time to go into that particular verse in all its detail. But there is always a moral alternative when we feel tempted. God provides that way out. So Paul has stated what the dangers are. Don't get involved with idolatry. And that's how he begins the next chapter. He calls them to flee from idolatry. Sorry, the next section, not the next chapter. To emphasize just how unacceptable, how inappropriate, how abhorrent it is to God, he invites them to think about the example of what is perhaps the most sacred part of our Christian practice, the thing that was central to our Christian faith, which is the communion table, the Lord's Supper, the cup of thanksgiving. He's inviting them to consider the significance of what it is that they are doing when they share this communion meal. Have you noticed how over time, as we do things repetitively and they become routine, we take for granted some remarkable things that we do? Let me give you a simple example. Take the act of making the blessed cup of tea. And specifically, boiling the water in a kettle. Think about what you do in the process. First, there's the water. The water that probably comes from tens, if not hundreds, of miles away. Maybe from some lake at the top of a mountain or a reservoir somewhere. There are fish swimming in it. There are birds doing things in it. It's fairly clean. That's the water that we're talking about. And then it comes from whatever that distant location is, and it comes through a succession of ever-decreasing diameter pipes, coming all the way through that distance, through our busy towns, under the roads, and it comes into pipes in your house to a tap in your kitchen. That water that's been stored into your kitchen. Isn't that amazing? And then you turn the tap on, which gives you the opportunity to put the kettle underneath, plug your electric kettle in, and you activate the switch. You complete the circuit, and you draw current. There's another whole 4 hours I've got, drawing current from the electricity grid. And that power is generated, again, possibly hundreds of miles away. It could be nuclear power that's supplying it. Wind power. And that comes down into your house through the wall. Astonishing. And as the current comes into your kettle, it passes through the element. It meets a resistance. The element warms up. And heat is conducted into the water. Hydrogen and oxygen atoms start vibrating against one another. And the water changes state from being liquid to being a vapor. And it becomes steam. And when you've got enough steam, it switches the kettle off and you can make the blessed cup of tea. And you say, put the kettle on. Do you know, even today, that thing that we take so for granted, if people in the developing world could understand what I've just said to you, they would see all of those events coming together as being practically magical. And we take it for granted. In just the same way, Paul says, you need to know what takes place when you partake in communion. And he challenges the Corinthians and he challenges us to reassess what is happening when we take that bread and the wine. This is not just a communion meal. Something so much deeper happens. We declare our unity. And not just with one another, but unity with Christ. Or as Paul puts it, we participate with Christ. It means that we align ourselves with the sacrifices that he made, the pain that he went through, the suffering. We align ourselves, we sympathize, we empathize, we begin to appreciate just what it is that he did for us. We share the one bread, the loaf of bread, the body of Christ. And this is true sharing. This is the fellowship meal. It is truly God's community. And when all of that happens, there is a spiritual connection. Like plugging in your kettle. There is a spiritual connection, which is why communion should never be trivialized. So having recognized the significance, Paul says this. He says, please, just think about it. This is not rocket science. He practically says that. He says, if you are one with Christ, how can we be at the same time one with idols in temples? And what they hadn't realized is that's exactly what they're doing when they take part in a meal in a temple. They are at one with demonic powers. Now hang on, you might say. Haven't we just concluded that Paul's saying that idols have no real existence? They have no powers in their own right. In themselves, they offer no threat. What is the big deal? Yeah, easily confused. Let me just put that into context. Let's think a moment for about what idols represent. We have seen so far, again and again in this book, how important idols are. They are central to Roman and Greek culture of this day. There were temples to them all over the place. And idols would be statues. They could be huge, they could be little figurines made out of wood, made out of stone. And in themselves, they have absolutely no power. They are not living. They are not evil in themselves. But here's the problem. With any idol, people credit to them power to do what only God can do. So, to influence the weather, to provide themselves with good crops, to bless them with children, to bring success in business, to bring contentment in life, for example. And whenever you open the door, whenever you rely on anything else to bring you those things, you open the door to evil forces, which make use of the worship. And that's what's happening when you are relying, you are worshipping those things. They make use of the worship that is being offered to a non-god, to a piece of wood or metal, whatever it might be, in order to gain power over the person and the people around them. As a result, superstition takes hold. Fear of what might happen if you stop doing those things. Maybe the crops will fail. Maybe my life won't be like this. Maybe I won't meet the right person. Fear grips them. It becomes an all-encompassing power. They lose control, and suddenly they're trapped in a cycle of dependence on something other than God. So idols do have real spiritual significance. Not because they are gods themselves, but rather because they're the place where demonic powers have influence. And if you want to sort of sense an example of that, just think about how people are driven, are trapped, when they get hooked into things that they feel eventually they have no control over. And Paul is saying, you can't afford to be complacent. You cannot mix the table of the Lord, where we're thinking what he's done for us. You can't mix a life of commitment to that with a life that is committed to something so abhorrent. Does this have any relevance for us today? Well, I doubt that anyone here will have a little statue of wood or stone or brass or anything else in your homes. I suspect you won't. Though I have noticed one or two of you've got gnomes in the garden. I think you can get away with that. But you know what? I actually think that idols are probably a bigger problem in our day than they ever were in his day. It's just that they're not made out of wood and stone. They are things which symbolize power, influence, pleasure, status, value, prestige. It's the things that we hold on to that speak of all of those things. The things that we guard so highly that they can take the place of God. Things that we put our trust and confidence in rather than in God alone. That could be our money. It could be our career. It could be our skills, even our ability to do things ourselves, our self-reliance. Self-reliance can be such an idol to us today. Or things that we develop a dependence on bringing satisfaction to our lives. They can be possessions. Our homes actually can become real idols. Our cars, our clothes, handbags, whatever it is that you're hooked into. Things that people buy under the impression, I'm going to be happier when I've bought that. Whenever we feel happier, I'd quite like to have an Aston Martin. That'd be nice. Going on my holidays soon. It'd be nice driving through Europe in an Aston Martin. But you know what? If I buy one, it's not going to keep me happy for very long, especially when I have to start putting fuel in it on a more regular basis and pay for the tyres and the servicing and so on. And it will go rusty. False offers of happiness. But people do that with everything, from shoes to handbags to whatever it might be. And then there are the things that distract us. Television, music, friendships, sex, addictions, even health. Things that we can't control. They bring anxiety when they're not available, and they bring distractions when they are present. And they're at work all around us. And if you're not sure about that, just think about what it happens when people allow money and war and sex to drive them to acts, to act in ways that they wouldn't ordinarily ever dream of acting in. And it happens when people start going down those roads. We underestimate how such things open the door to the demonic. And in the West, for Christians particularly, we need to learn that the demonic is not as remote and distant as we might like to think it is. The enemy is cunning, and he sucks us into things. And Paul is saying to them, and he says to us, that all of those things are completely incompatible with people who would claim allegiance to Christ, lordship to him. And so he closes by just clarifying, where has he got to with this whole thing of eating food sacrificed to idols? Well, he returns to it right at the end. He's determined already that eating at the temple as part of worship is completely unacceptable, because this is worshipping idols themselves. Just don't do it. But what about that food that was also offered, that is made available because it's in excess and it's sold in the marketplace? What about that? Well, he makes two simple points. He says, first of all, as a Christian, there are no rules. You don't need to worry about those sorts of things. You are free. You have freedom to eat what you like. The old Jewish restrictions don't apply to you. Meat itself is just meat. It hasn't been defined, so you can eat it. But, and here's the key point of what this passage is all about. If you were to go to someone's home, if a person acknowledges in that place that this meat has been sacrificed to idols, they are making an attachment to it. They are attaching significance to it. And for the conscience of that person, you should not eat it. Paul is not imposing new rules. He's saying you're free, so enjoy your freedom, but be aware of what other people feel on this subject. Show consideration to them. And he summarizes it in this dual phrase right at the end. Everything is possible or lawful, but not everything is beneficial. Everything is permissible, but not everything is constructive. You know, for a Christian, there are so many freedoms because of Christ. But exercising that freedom isn't always beneficial to either us, or especially to those who are young in the faith and can misinterpret motives and what's behind it, or who haven't come to faith and are watching our example. And we need to be really careful. And so he implores them, whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. How do your actions impact the faith of other people? Are you really confident about what you believe, what's right and what's wrong? How do other people look at what you do as you do it? Is it okay for a Christian to go to a pub? Of course it is. There's nothing wrong in itself with alcohol. But if the person that you're going with struggles with alcohol addiction, stay away. Don't do it. Is it okay for a Christian to go to a car boot sale? Of course it is. But if someone you're going with has a real addiction to that, because they feel that somehow they're going to find that little Rembrandt, they're going to sell for millions, if they're hooked on it, and this is their lottery ticket, don't go. Don't do it. You have freedom, but it's not beneficial. Is it okay not to be here on a Sunday morning, once or twice, and do something else because you want to do it with a family? Well, of course it is. There are not legalistic restrictions anymore that says you've got to be here. But if someone who's young in the faith or not a Christian looks at what you do and sees that you are sending another message that says, God's not that big a deal. I can take him, or I could watch telly. Get your backside here, because that's sending a very bad message. It's how our faith and our actions impact other people that really matters. Paul's principle in everything, in all the actions that he does, is this: don't do what you like best, but do what is best for other people. And that's challenging. But what he's doing is he's simply following the example of the Messiah himself, who came to this world, gave up his rightful position in heaven, and surrendered himself to be abused, beaten, crucified, humiliated, and killed. Because your benefit was so much more important to him. That's how he closes the passage. Actually, it's verse 1 of chapter 11, which should be part of this. I wonder whether our actions are the same, so that the things that we do serve to bring glory to God and bless other people. Let's pray.